Brothers and sisters, we continue our series on prayers this evening, and Brother Howard Cook is to speak to us on the prayer of Solomon, recorded in the first book of Kings, chapter 8. Brother Howard has asked us to introduce his address by a reading of part of that chapter. So we're going to read the first of Kings, chapter 8, beginning at verse 22, and reading through to verse 54. So that's 1 of Kings, chapter 8, and beginning at verse 22. So we now invite Brother Howard to speak to us on the prayer of Solomon in 1 of Kings, chapter 8. Brother Howard.
Dear brothers and sisters, we've been reading in that eighth chapter of the first book of Kings about a momentous day in the very midst of the reign of King Solomon. Perhaps the greatest day in the life of Solomon and also the nation of Israel. Part of the lavish ceremony that was involved in the dedication of the newly completed temple. We're even told in the second verse of the chapter that at the time of the year that it was, at the feast in the month of Ethanaim, Tishri that is, which is the seventh month, that's roughly September, October of our year, the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, the harvest festival, which lasted 7 days in itself, and there were, I think, seven more days added because of the dedication ceremony, one of the three occasions in the year when the whole nation was commanded to gather together at Jerusalem. It's also appropriate that it was the Feast of Tabernacles, in a sense, because it was at this moment that the old tabernacle, again verse 4 tells us about this, that the old tabernacle or tent, which was the centre of worship hitherto, was packed up and its holy contents were now placed inside a building of stone, which had been constructed at great expense, at great labour, in a very special way. Impermanence then replaced by permanence. And it was then that we are told in verses 11 and 12 that the glory of God filled the new building. A new building which was perhaps the most magnificent of its time. So this then was the setting for Solomon's prayer, his prayer following his dedication, following the dedication of this building. Prayer to God, asking for his blessing upon what would now be continue to be done in that building, inhabited by God's presence. It is, in fact, we believe, one of the few substantial prayers recorded in the Bible. It's on a par with Daniel's great prayer recorded in chapter 9 of his prophecy, Ezra and Nehemiah, both in the books that bear their name. And it wasn't, despite its occasion, or perhaps because of its occasion, it wasn't a proud, self-aggrandizing prayer, as it surely would have been if it had been a pagan ruler, say, praying for the future of a pagan temple. Because Solomon here was praying to the God of heaven, the God who inhabits the universe, the true creator of all things, all those other gods were masquerading as gods. This was the true God inhabiting the universe. And he was very conscious in this prayer of the great honour for Israel as having been chosen through David, his father, for the site in his chosen city of Jerusalem for God's dwelling place on earth. And so the keynote of this prayer is surely the word humility. Nothing proud about the prayer at all, a very humble prayer. In fact, the phrase prayer and supplication is a recurring phrase, as we shall see. Solomon was all too aware of the failings of God's people, amongst whom he would include himself, which worked very much against their suitability for being the host of this building, which was going to undermine the presence of God in their midst if they weren't careful. And that is very much the theme of this prayer. And we should also remember that we are talking about God's kingdom in the past. God was in fact the king of this kingdom, despite the fact that Solomon, the son of David, in fact was the Lord's anointed. A very special relationship between this people and God, and also a very special responsibility on their shoulders, which seems to have involved a very direct correlation between falling and punishment. And all this, this humility, this sense of a great burden being placed on the nation, was reflected in the stance of Solomon as he gave this prayer. We are told in verse 22 that he initially stood with his hands outspread facing the altar, but at the conclusion of the prayer, by the time he reached verse 54, Solomon was kneeling with his hands outspread. And it was from that kneeling position that he then turned to face the people for the final blessing of the people recorded in the last verses of the chapter. So at some point, probably almost at the beginning of his prayer, he must have fallen to his knees. And in that posture, that stance, he would have uttered this prayer. And finally, in setting the scene for the prayer, we can imagine the people gathered in front of the king, or rather behind the king, in front of him when he turned to directly bless them, but while he was giving this prayer facing the altar, they would have been behind him. The leaders and heads of families, probably on the Temple Mount, directly on the Temple Mount, a much more limited area than it would have become by the time of Herod's temple, centuries later. Only room, perhaps, for them. But then we can imagine the whole nation spread across the slopes facing the temple, including, one imagines, the other side of the brook Kidron, up covering the Mount of Olives. So that's the setting, then, for this prayer. And we have to note that, first of all, although it's not actually part of our subject tonight, Solomon proceeded to bless Israel. A very long blessing recorded in the seven verses from 14 to 21 of our chapter. And if we were to summarise, David is expressing his desire to build, or rather, Solomon is telling, or in the prayer, is, not in the prayer, but telling the people of David's desire to build this temple, a fulfilment of a desire that he was told would happen through his son, Solomon, the ultimate fulfilment of the Davidic promise. And so then to the prayer itself, which is contained in this chapter, chapter 8, it's repeated in the second book of Chronicles, chapter 6, practically word for word. But we're going to confine ourselves to this chapter. And perhaps we could start by summarising the prayer, which runs from verses 22 to 53 of the chapter, just perhaps to get an idea of the progression of thought in the prayer. And it can actually be divided up into a series of, we might call stanzas, either double or triple, sometimes a longer number of verses. And if I could just run through those basic subdivisions, if you just wanted to note them or mark them in some way, what I've called the 11 stanzas of this prayer. And so the first double verse part of this prayer, verse 22 and 23, where Solomon is acknowledging the majesty of God and the greatness of his manifestation through his people. Then the second stanza, verse 25 and 26, the promises to David, his father, are referred to. Then verses 27 to 30, a note of doubt appears in the prayer. Could the God of heaven conceivably dwell on earth in an earthly building, a building of stone, the one who inhabits the heaven? And then there was a plea for God to hear prayer, not just Solomon's prayer, but other prayers in this place or directed to this place in particular circumstances. Four are mentioned, verses 31, 32, oath-taking requirements for which the temple would be used. Verses 33 and 34, when the nation was defeated in battle because of sin, verses 35 to 36, drought coming on the nation because of sin, verses 37 to 40, famine because of sin. Those are four circumstances in which pleas could be directed to the Almighty from this place, particular circumstances. And then the prayer moves on, 41 to 43, concerning the foreigner who comes to Israel to visit the temple, 44 to 45, Israel going out to battle, seeking God's blessing on the enterprise, 46 to 51, a recognition of the inevitability of sin, and then the possibility of captivity and exile as a result. And then verse 52, a final plea for God to listen to Solomon's supplication. And then verse 53 refers back, the last verse of the prayer, to the covenant in Sinai after the delivery of Israel from Egypt. And so then we go back to the beginning of the prayer, just to look at some of those sections in more detail. Verses 23 to 24, where the majesty of God is referred to, a majesty that can be seen and that in no other of the gods of men. Nothing like the true majesty of God who inhabits the heavens. Manifested in a covenant of mercy, particularly towards David. And verse 24 indicates that no other God has acted in history like the God of Israel, performing great miracles, changing the course of events to perform his covenants towards his people, recorded in Exodus and Deuteronomy. What God has spoken with his mouth, he has performed. And there's also a reference, a direct reference in verse 23, to David, the promise made to David, your covenant with David, and your mercy to your servants. So that's the first stanza of this prayer. And then it goes on to the second, verses 25 and 26, where Solomon prays that God keeps the promise that he has made to his father David, relating to his descendants, that they may not fail to sit on his throne. That's his expression. A reference back to the actual promise recorded in the second book of Samuel. Perhaps we could just turn back to chapter 7 of the second book of Samuel, verse 12, just a couple of verses from this covenant. Verse 12, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish a throne of his kingdom forever. And then verse 16, your house and your kingdom shall be established forever. Your throne shall be established forever. Before you, before God, that is. This then was a reference to the descendants of David, the first of whom was Solomon, actually able in himself to build this magnificent temple. Although the line of that descent, if indeed there was to be a line of descendants, ultimately depended on the walk, the way of life of those descendants, if only their walk is worthy. And that, as the subsequent history of Israel shows, even the history of Solomon's reign, was a very big ask. Although, of course, it has its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus, great David's greater son, the great descendant through whom the promises, the Messiah indeed, will be finally fulfilled. And then verse 26, the prayer of Solomon, that let your word come true. What would that have been? It would have been a reference to my rest. This is my rest. Verse 26. We get that phrase from Psalm 132, Psalm 132, verse 14. 132, verse 14, a reference by the psalmist back to the promises to David. This is my resting place forever. The Lord has chosen Zion, the previous verse. He has desired it for his habitation. This is my resting place forever. Here I will dwell, for I have desired it. The idea of rest, peace, as the ultimate purpose for this temple, is a very important aspect of the promise to David. And so we move on then to verses 27 to 30. four verses in all, quite a long section, in which Solomon expresses almost a sudden doubt that's come into his mind as he's giving this prayer. Will God indeed dwell on the earth? Is he actually able to inhabit it, such a limited place as this wooden, as this stone building, magnificent as it is? And in fact, verse 27, in expressing the sheer extent of God's habitation in the heavens, uses a very important intensification: heaven and heaven of heavens. It repeats the word heavens three times, which shows, it was an indication in the Hebrew, we believe, of that the Almighty inhabits infinity. There's no other way of expressing it. And yet he has chosen this place as his dwelling place on earth. And yet God far transcends containment anywhere in his universe, however magnificent the building might be that has been built to containment. And there is an implication in this, that God dwelling in this temple is not an irreversible situation. The presence of God in this building, bearing in mind that he actually inhabits in eternity, infinity, his presence in this building ultimately depends on his forgiveness of Israel's failings. And yet, verse 28 contains a plea for God to hear prayer in this place, a prayer that was being given on that day by Solomon and in future by Israel, so that, verse 29, his eyes will continue to be open to this place, which of course indicates a possibility that that may not happen in certain situations. And we notice also, verse 30, that the prayers of others will be delivered, and the phrase is, towards this place. Not just Solomon standing by the altar of burnt offering, facing the holiest, holy of holies, the holiest place of the temple, but Israelites, followers of God, wherever they were, in the villages and towns of the land, and also when they were further afield, perhaps taken from their land in captivity. We remember, don't we, Daniel kneeling in prayer in Babylon three times a day towards Jerusalem, fulfilling that aspect, you know, in very extreme circumstances of Solomon's prayer. But there now follows, in verse 30, a plea for God to hear those prayers being directed towards the temple in the following instances. There were four of them. Verse 31 and 32, the first one, when there are sins against neighbours, when the law enforcement role of the law of Moses required an alleged wrongdoer to take an oath where insufficient evidence, either to do with unfulfilled pledges or perhaps alleged adultery, this was a divinely given means of determining innocence or guilt, direct action that could only take place through prayer before the temple or in the vicinity of the temple. Well, that's the first kind of plea that Solomon mentions. The second, 33 and 34, where Israel is defeated because of sin, defeated in battle, one of the covenant curses listed in Deuteronomy chapter 28, which expresses it as, you shall go out one way before them and flee seven ways, then there should be pleas in the temple to bring back those inevitably taken captive in that situation. The third kind of plea, verses 35 and 36, was when there was a drought situation, when the heavens are closed up, when there is no rain because of sin. When, again, Deuteronomy 28 puts it, the Lord will change the rain of your land to powder and to dust. Verse 36 then indicates the reason for that drought. It was to be part of a teaching process, when God would teach them the good way so that they would learn from their experiences. And then we come to the fourth plea, kind of plea that could be uttered in prayer to the temple. A long passage, this, four verses, verses 37 to 40, which begins by talking about, verse 37, famine, which would be the result of ravages listed, almost the same as those again predicted in Deuteronomy 28. Pestilence, blight, mildew, locusts or grasshoppers, also diseases, and the hunger, which might well be the result of sieges, enemies prevailing against Israel on their own land. Then, Solomon prays, may prayers reflect the turmoil in each heart. Verse 39, the plague of his own heart, within the heart of an individual prayer before the temple, known only to God. Verses 38 and 39, when each one knows the plague of his own heart and spreads out his hands towards this temple, then hear in heaven your dwelling place and forgive and act and give to everyone according to all his ways, whose heart you know, for you, only you, know the hearts of all the sons of men. Even where perhaps the punishment, the national punishment that was being meted out on the nation, was not entirely commensurate with the deeds of individual Israelites. So that God's instruction, if that was the reason for these plagues that were coming on the land, may be tempered to the individual needs of his people. And so that those are the, seems to have been the four circumstances, specific circumstances, for pleas to the temple. And so Solomon's prayer moves on then, verse 41 to 43 of this chapter, where Solomon turns his attention to the foreigner. Moreover, concerning the foreigner who comes from another land to worship at the temple. This kind of situation was going to have a fulfillment, wasn't it, in the visit of the Queen of Sheba to Solomon, recorded in a couple of chapters on in this book. We can think of other examples of Gentiles who have come to worship God, having heard of the great name of the God of Israel. We think of Rahab, of Ruth, in New Testament times, the Ethiopian eunuch. they were all to be given a welcome when they approached the temple. And it's interesting, isn't it? Verse 42 refers to that phrase, your great name, which has come to their attention. Speaker's commentary points out that that is actually a very rarely used phrase in the Bible. Its significance is, of course, the referring to the great name of God, reputed abroad because of his great deeds. Was it also a reference to the Yahweh name, known about, perhaps, beyond the confines of Israel? And the plea extends, verse 43, to all the peoples of the earth, that they too may come to this temple. And then verses 44 and 45, when your people go out to battle, military initiatives under the law were allowed for if they were undertaken with divine sanction. Then that sanction was to be sought through prayer, verse 45, that God maintain their cause, if those prayers were offered in the right way through the temple. And then verses 46 to 51, a very long passage this, of some six verses, Solomon directly confronts the possibility of Israel being taken captive. Where they sin, verse 46, that's the situation where they will be taken captive. And then a very remarkable insight follows. When they sin against you, for there is no one, in brackets it's here, for there is no one who does not sin. And then you become angry with them and deliver them to the enemy. Could that passage, in parenthesis, almost an aside by Solomon, have been in the mind of Paul when he declared that, in Romans, that all have sinned and come and fallen short of the glory of God? And as a result, in Solomon's prayer, they go into captivity because of the anger of God. On the basis of predictions made in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, Solomon recognized that stubborn disobedience would lead to exile from the promised land. His prayer was that God would deliver Israel as his people and his inheritance, brought out of Egypt, which is described in verse 51 as an iron smelting furnace, a furnace of iron. That's what Israel was brought out from. That's what they could return to. That your eyes may be open to the supplication of your servant and your people, prayers for delivery offered through the temple. And verse 53, the final verse of the prayer, emphasizes the bringing out of Egypt and the Sinaitic covenant that followed. And so the prayer concludes with Solomon kneeling with his back to the people, but kneeling towards the altar of burnt offering. And so it was that when Solomon had finished praying all this prayer and supplication to the Lord, that he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hand spread up to heaven. This prayer, the inspired chronicler writing the Book of Kings, the chronicle of the book, which we call the Book of Kings, and then another inspired writer writing the Book of Chronicles, must have had access, it has been suggested, to a document which would have been the record, someone must have made at the time of this prayer. And the speaker's commentary, in fact, points out that that is what goes against theories about the late origin of the books of the Pentateuch, particularly Leviticus and Deuteronomy, which are referred to quite copiously in this prayer uttered by King Solomon. And so then, verses 55 to 61, comes his declaration, his benediction on the people, where, verse 56, he prays that rest, and the margin refers, renders it as peace, may come to his people. A peace that came about following the victory, following the victories of Solomon's father, King David, which of course prefigures the even greater rest to God's people. That's one of the blessings that Solomon hopes for in his final benediction. There's also a prayer, verse 58, that the people incline their hearts to him, incline our hearts to him, that there should be a national reformation as a result of the dedication of this wonderful building. And then verse 59 refers to Solomon as his servant, God's servant, an indication, a further indication of Solomon's humility as he gave this prayer, despite his personal wealth and glory as the king of this nation at peace. Solomon still saw himself as a servant, prefiguring, of course, God's righteous servant, the great Messiah, predicted in the prophecy of Isaiah. And so then we've seen then the great prayer, we've heard the great prayer delivered on this momentous day in King Solomon's reign, the occasion of the dedication of the newly completed temple. We can imagine, as we've said, the people gathered in front of the king, leaders and heads of families, and the whole nation spread across the slopes facing the temple when the glory of God filled the new building, the setting for Solomon's prayer. Indeed, it has been suggested that Solomon's prayer anticipates Jesus' prayer for us, his followers, spiritual Israel, contained in John chapter 17. Solomon has prayed, hasn't he, for his own house, for his nation as a whole, and then for those of foreign extraction who would come to share the hope. And it can be seen that, in fact, those are the themes of that great prayer by his great descendant, Jesus, regarding his followers, spiritual Israelites. And it's certainly, as we've seen, it wasn't a proud prayer. Prayer and supplication are its recurring phrases. It was a prayer to be followed by all who were to pray towards this temple, following Solomon's example. And it's an example, as we saw verses 38 and 39, for us as well, individually and collectively. That was the prayer that referred to reflecting the turmoil in each heart that faced the temple, the plague of his own heart, known only to God. Our prayer is that God's instruction through trial and tribulation for us may be tempered to the individual needs of his people, and that includes ourselves. Bearing in mind, again in that other phrase from the prayer, there is no one who does not sin. And so finally, in conclusion, we look to the future, don't we? We look to another temple that will be built when Jesus returns to the earth. A temple predicted by the prophet Isaiah in the 57th chapter of his prophecy. Chapter 56, verse 6. Also the sons of the foreigner who join themselves to the Lord to serve him. He's talking about the regathering of Israel in the future. The sons of the foreigner who join themselves to the Lord to serve him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants. Everyone who keeps from defiling the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant, even then I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, not just Israel, but that would include ourselves as Gentiles. The Lord God, who gathers the outcasts of Israel, says, yet I will gather to him others besides those who are gathered to him. A house of prayer for all nations. And so our prayer now is that we may be found worthy in that day to participate in the worship of that temple and so enjoy the blessings of the future age.